Welcome back to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Late June marked the anniversary of the Battle of the Little Bighorn in Montana Territory in 1876. The U.S. 7th Cavalry was defeated by the combined forces of Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho tribes in what's become known as Custer's Last Stand. But before his last stand, George Armstrong Custer spent about a decade on the Great Plains. And Nebraska historian Jeff Barnes writes about Custer's experiences west of the Mississippi in his book, The Great Plains Guide to Custer, 85 Forts, Fights, and Other Sites. And Jeff Barnes is back home in Nebraska after giving presentations on Custer, coinciding with the Little Bighorn anniversary, including one at the Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre a couple weeks ago. And he joins us on the line. Jeff, thanks for taking the time to join us on Dakota Midday.
Well, thanks for having me, Carl. I really appreciate it, especially since I didn't make it a couple of weeks ago when I was supposed to be on.
Well, it's great that you're with us today. I'm curious, in putting the book together, were there enough historical records to know exactly where it was that Custer traveled?
I got surprised by what was out there. I mean, the thing about Custer, so much gets focused on with the Little Bighorn and leading up to it, and then, of course, his Civil War career, but it's sometimes forgotten how much he did out here on the Great Plains before he got to Little Bighorn. It was quite an extensive history, and I was really surprised and impressed with the ground that was covered.
What led you to want to follow Custer's path?
Well, it was it's kind of funny. My first book was about the military forts of the Northern Plains, including the Dakotas and Nebraska and Montana. And then I was going to be doing a book on the Southern forts and heard the former chief historian for the National Park Service, Robert Utley, speaking. He said, you know, to get people interested in books, you need to write about people who people know. And I thought, well, there's George Custer, and he's visited a lot of the forts that I was going to write about in the South and the North, and I thought, you know, maybe I could switch it and make it a book about him and just tie in everything that way. And that's kind of what got me into Custer. And there are so many Custer books out there, and of course I needed a different angle. And so I thought, well, if I talk about the places that he went to, and so people could walk in his footsteps, that might be a difference maker for that, and it's turned out to be that way so far.
What sort of insight does that give us into George Custer's life during those years after the Civil War, but before the Last Stand?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the life on the Great Plains was far different than the life he experienced in the Civil War. He had a great deal of success during the Civil War. In fact, some people say he may have saved the Union at Gettysburg with his successful repulse of Jeb Stuart there. But when he got out to the Great Plains, he found out that the soldiers were not the same. They were a little more unorganized and less likely to follow commands. And he also found out the enemy was not the same. I mean, Indians certainly did not fight the way Confederates fought. They tended to attack and run, and in much smaller groups, but much more specific in how they struck at their objective. So it was a very difficult situation for him and for the Army. But he ultimately was the most successful commander, at least until Little Bighorn.
When did Custer first cross the Mississippi and come to this area, this region?
Well, he first crossed the Mississippi in 1865, right after the Civil War. He was in Texas for a short while, but then he came to Kansas in 1866 for the organization of the 7th Cavalry at Fort Riley. And so that put him on the Southern Plains for about 1869. And then it was in 1873 that he made his first entrance into the Dakotas. And that's where he was for the last 3 years of his life.
In going back to when he first arrived in Kansas, I believe he was stationed in Fort Riley. What was his relationship then with the Native American people?
He had actually no relationship at all, and I think it's you could almost call him a pacifist when it came to the Indians at that time, because his very first encounter. Well, I mean, he was sent to punish a group of Indians that had been suspected of raids, and he came back and reported to General Hancock these weren't the Indians we were looking for. Well, Hancock went and destroyed their village anyway. Custer was more inclined to negotiate with Indians at the time and give them supplies to kind of persuade him to do what he wanted to do. His very first stand against Indians was here in Nebraska, and he tried to negotiate his way out of that, and I guess he successfully did. But he was really criticized for not attacking Indians and for taking more of a peaceful role with them in his initial years. And it wasn't until the Battle of the Washita that he became really known as an Indian fighter.
Was there something that changed in him, or was it just his experience?
Well, I think it was his being suspended from the Army for a while and being so roundly criticized by his commanders for not being more aggressive with the Indians that kind of led him to say, you know, if I'm going to stay in this Army, I'm going to have to change my outlook and attitude toward the Indians. I'm going to have to be more aggressive. But even then, this was shown at the Battle of Washita, he took hostages as soon as he could to end the fights. He didn't want to wipe out the Indians, as many people have said. He wanted to get in there, finish the job just as quickly as possible. Taking hostages was how he did that. You know, Indians wouldn't attack anymore if hostages were being held, and he used that tactic quite a bit to achieve the objective. So he wasn't nearly as bloodthirsty as some have said.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and with us is Nebraska historian Jeff Barnes, who writes about Custer's experiences west of the Mississippi in his book, The Great Plains Guide to Custer, 85 Forts, Fights, and Other Sites. Now Custer first came to South Dakota and what is now South Dakota in, what, about 1873
in April, and that's when the 7th Cavalry was getting reorganized to be stationed in the northern part of the territory, and they first arrived in Yankton. That's where they kind of got organized, and kind of somewhat typical hospitality. They got hit by a blizzard as soon as they got there, and kind of made them disorganized for a while. But and Custer got a very very strong head cold while he was in Yankton as well. But eventually they did get organized and made the long march up the Missouri River to what is now Fort Abraham Lincoln in North Dakota.
And then he ended up in the hills, 1874, and that was the expedition that led to the gold rush. And if I understand my history correctly, this was essentially an illegal operation, since this was, according to treaties, this belonged to the Native Americans?
That's true. Well, it was kind of quasi-illegal. They had a lot of problems with raids into Nebraska, the settlements along the border from the Black Hills. And so the thinking was the Army said we need to have a fort of some kind in the Black Hills or near the Black Hills to address that. But there was also the rumors of gold, and the United States was going through a depression at the time. The Panic of 1873 had pretty much shut down the money supply, and so the United States was looking for money wherever they could find it. And that the thinking was let's check out these rumors of gold in the Black Hills. So it kind of had a dual purpose, and Custer was the one that led that expedition to find that.
Looking at the places that you write about that you visited for your Great Plains Guide to Custer, are there certain places that are favorites of yours that are especially fascinating?
I hate to say it, but Little Bighorn is a favorite. I've been there 6 times and always find something new that I didn't find there before, and I know there's always things that I need to find when I'm up there. It's all really interesting. You know, just outside of the Black Hills is a mountain called Indian Care. It's just over the border in Wyoming, but that's part of the Black Hills. And that's where Custer climbed to try to find his way to get into the Black Hills. And while he was there, he left a sort of a permanent souvenir on top of it. And I give you instructions in the book on how to get to that site. But it's all these kind of little nuanced things that you don't really hear about. Well, you wouldn't hear about it in the history books, and just finding them and letting people know where they are.
I imagine that a lot of these places are, you know, over 100 years later, quite a bit different from what Custer saw.
There are a few, but I'm really struck by for the most part, if you go to these places today, they haven't changed really a lot from what Custer saw. The mountains that he went through, the Black Hills and the Washita Mountains in Oklahoma, You know, a lot of the spots on the plains are still wide open prairie. You might see, of course, fence there now, but you'll see a lot of the things that he saw, much as he saw them today. And it's really amazing the amount of miles that he he put through his horses there. He covered a lot of ground, really, really a tremendous amount of space that would pass beneath him. And it is kind of fun to know that it does look much as he would have seen it too.
Well, were these places difficult to find, or you were able to spot them?
Oh, some of them were a little tricky. There are local folks that do help. They know the stories, and they can help get you to the site. And some of the sites actually have been marked, such as that Indian village that he was supposed to destroy in Kansas. They've actually got a marker there now. It's out in the country. But you know, like the forts, like Fort Leavenworth and Fort Riley, Fort Abraham Lincoln, they're all there. You know exactly where he was and what happened there. But others are kind of tricky, and like the Yankton one, where his camp was set up, that involved finding some maps from back in the 1870s and getting into the stories of the newspapers at the time to actually pinpoint where those sites were.
Well, Jeff Barnes, you were saying that you wrote this book partly because you wanted to focus on someone that people know about. Why do you think it is that people continue to be fascinated by George Custer all these years later?
I think it's probably because his death was so spectacular, and so many, I mean, with him dying and everybody around him dying, there's just mysteries that'll never be solved. And you know, people always want to take a crack at him and offer their ideas. And people are very, very opinionated about him, too. I mean, he's, you know, people say that he wasn't a friend to the Indians. Well, actually, he was. I mean, he had Crow Scouts. He had Arikara Scouts. I mean, he even said himself, if he had his druthers, he would rather be living his life as a Plains Indian. I think just the controversy over his death and how it was examined by the Army and the results that came out of it, I think it's just always a constant debate. And he was a colorful personality, so that adds to it as well. And just the enduring mystery of it all, and I think that's just going to keep him popular or discussed for a long time.
Well, yeah, given the controversial nature of his life, he was a hero during the Civil War, but yet the Custer of the Indian Wars is a much more controversial character, and so he's loathed by many people. How do you think history should consider Custer, or how should we consider Custer in looking at his career as a whole?
I would think people should, you know, one thing I hear discussed quite a bit, I think people should see him as a better commander than he actually was. I mean, true, he was horrible to his men, but his tactics, I don't really think they could be argued with much. Just from what happened at the battlefield, I think he was planning the same strategy that worked for him at the Battle of Ouachita in Oklahoma. And I know his successors that took over for him afterwards, they used the same tactics that he was using, and they even gave him credit for that as well. So I don't think he was as bad a military commander as was said. As to how he treated his men, he probably was as bad as what was said. Mm-hmm. He was pretty hard on his men, but he had an incredible stamina himself. I mean, he would march all day on his horse and then come back into camp and do some taxidermy and write 40-page articles for magazines and 12-page letters to his wife. And he had been getting by on just 4 hours of sleep a day. just incredible physical stamina.
Well, Jeff Barnes, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us on Dakota Midday today. I understand that this fall you'll be back in South Dakota talking about Custer and the Dakotas?
Yes, I will be September 19th, Thursday. I'll be doing the lunchtime program at the Homestead Adams Museum in Deadwood. And I'm really looking forward to that. It's the first opportunity I have to give a Custer talk in the Black Hills, so I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, Jeff, again, thanks for joining us on Dakota Midday.
Well, thanks for having me, Carl. I really, really appreciate it.
That's Nebraska historian Jeff Barnes. He's author of the historical travel guide, The Great Plains Guide to Custer, 85 Forts, Fights, and Other Sites. You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk with composer and jazz pianist Daniel May.